Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
American Wilderness is 40 years old tomorrow. Happy birthday, Wilderness. We continue our wilderness adventure as we head on out to Yosemite National Park, a taproot of American Wilderness, and Dr. Bonnie Geisel. When we return here on the Wildside News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
And so now we continue our journey from Yosemite National Park with the curator of the Sierra Club's LeConte Lodge, Dr. Bonnie Geisel. Bonnie, you're calling us from a historic place in the history of wilderness as you sit and work in the lodge in Yosemite in 2004, one day before its 40th birthday, the anniversary of the Wilderness Act. What are you thinking about?
Well, I'm here in paradise for many people around the world. This is a pilgrimage and the opportunity to come to this amazing park. You know, the oldest park in the history of our national park system, though, as we know, the Yellowstone Park was acclaimed as the first national park in 1872. Yosemite National Park was really set aside in 1864. As the first land in perpetuity put aside for American people from visitors all over the world to enjoy this very special wilderness experience. It's a beautiful day here. It's going to be in the low 90s. The sun is shining, and it's a little quiet as we get ready for the busy weekend, the last holiday weekend of the season. And, just the opportunity to celebrate and experience, share some of my own experiences and my own understanding and care and concern for nature and wilderness everywhere is just a wonderful opportunity.
You know, the LeConte Lodge is legendary because of an earlier resident there, Ansel Adams. And in our conversations, we've talked about a rather interesting bit of the history of wilderness, and that is the role that Ansel Adams played. And why don't you talk about him, the lodge, and that relationship to wilderness?
Well, Ansel Adams was the curator here from 1920 until 1923. He was initially a piano player. He wanted to be a professional pianist, but he sort of got hooked on the whole idea of capturing wilderness right here in Yosemite National Park. The initial response in terms of trying to establish this Wilderness Act was in part benefited by Ansel Adams in an exhibit held here at LeConte Memorial Lodge in 1955 called This is the American Earth. As a result of that project, Ansel Adams, Nancy Newhall, and David Brower put together a book in 1960 called This is the American Earth. The book was a milestone in conservation publishing, and it certainly helped to initiate a response with regard to the passage of the Wilderness Act in 1964.
Well, we've come a long way since then. Of course, that book and those images, so many of the images and the writings have such an important aspect of play such an important role in wilderness and its vision. And we've talked about that, the importance of those in terms of really creating that for people who otherwise may not have had a chance to visit wilderness. And I know this is something that both you and I are thinking about, and that is, how do we share this experience? I mentioned the artists and the writers because they manage certain major writers and artists manage to put that out to the public. But here we are, it's 2004, and now we're really challenged by trying to keep that vision alive, and I know that's one of your passions. What are you doing? How do you approach that these days?
Well, I always tell people, you know, we stand on the shoulders of those that preceded us in their great concerns and care for nature and the environment. People like Thoreau, John Muir, and Leopold. Leopold was a real key factor, his writings about the land ethic with regard to the passage of the Wilderness Act in 1964. As I said, the Ansel Adams, This is the American Earth, the idea of helping people to understand that these processes, these ideas are old. They sit well within us. They help us to understand what America is made of, that this is what shaped us, that this is who we are, that this is the tenor of our voice and the beat of our hearts and the wave of our arms, and that this is the great expanse of America, inclusive of the great photographs of Ansel Adams and the writings of Thoreau, particularly Maine Woods and Muir, and his whole understanding of truth as visible in nature, the invisible truth visible in nature. Today, we have one of the things Thoreau said in an article called Huckleberries is that we're all schoolmasters and our schoolhouse is the universe, and that we've neglected scenery and that this is sort of an absurdity. And Aldo Leopold went on to say that education is headed away from rather than toward an intense consciousness of land. I guess it's my hope in small places like LeConte Memorial Lodge and across the United States and literally around the world that we can find ways to try to understand and excite the sense of the universe or the world or the earth or our country being a schoolhouse rather than seeing education as stopping at a certain point in our lives, opening ourselves up to being educated on a continual basis. We spoke the other day about freedom is not free. I sort of see this as what I call paddle back to the future. We know that wilderness made civilization meaningful, and we know that civilization made wilderness essential. But I think that we're so far ahead of ourselves technologically that we need to paddle back to the future. We need to sort of go back a little bit in our own sensitivities and find a way to kind of nurture ourselves and understand where we're going with regard to what we value in nature and wilderness. In the 19th century, women were considered the fourth branch of government. They taught their children about reverence for nature for a variety of reasons. One was that it was the visible God. It was invisible God made visible. It was a way they experienced their faith. Also, it was, as I said, absolute truth, that there was no question that what you saw in nature was exactly what was there. Third was because of the whole concept of pharmaceuticals, that nature provided us with medicines, and so we had to understand what that was all about. That it was a way for us to understand ourselves, to tell our stories, because we know that we assign meaning to the world and we create our sense of values through our storytelling, and nature became part and parcel of that. And the other one is relationships and community. That is, we strive to understand ourselves in a group of people in a given landscape, and that this is our sense of community. We've gotten away from a lot of that, and that's basically what Thoreau and Leopold are reminding us, that we're all schoolmasters, that our schoolhouse is the universe, that our schoolhouse is our country, that the wilderness places that we revere and that we care so much about and we put aside in perpetuity for future generations are really a storehouse or a library of possibility of understanding. So, like I said, for me it's a matter of sort of paddling back to the future, that we can understand where we've come from and what we need to do to kind of resurrect, to reconnect, to find ways to help ourselves. And this is something we all need to do for each other.
What is the intrinsic value of wilderness as we look out into the future to us, to our children, to our children's children?
Well, this is probably the most important question, and that is this issue of anthropocentrism versus biocentrism. That really means humanity versus nature. What's more important? And we're always kind of battling one side of this against another, thinking perhaps the whole idea that grew out of the battle between John Muir and Gifford Pinchot was over resource development, and Muir felt essentially that nature intrinsically had its own value, that there should be places we may not go, but that we appreciate and care for nonetheless, because in our hearts, in our souls, they're part of who we are. They're part of how we understand our humanity, our place in the world, where Gifford Pinchot said, greatest good for the greatest number for the greatest duration of time. That is, that nature had to be seen first and foremost as a resource for us to develop in all ways possible. So the question really is one of how do we find some kind of balance? How do we maybe simplify our lives or seek opportunities and possibilities of change to help us identify and understand all the bits and pieces that fall under the auspices of what we call the natural world. Now, we know for certain that there are many resources that are finite. And some of us know that physically and spiritually we depend on sustaining the planet in relatively an unaltered state. You know, we know things are going to change to some degree, but we know that the way things are is pretty much what's really working best for us. But the point is that without diversity and without understanding and without setting aside land, as has been done in the Wilderness Act, the sense of diversity, the biodiversity that is required for life is just going to not be there for us into the future and for nature itself.
Dr. Bonnie Geisel, we both agree that the best way to learn about nature is to go there. Is that right?
That's correct.
Thank you so much for sharing all your thoughts and your spirit and soul here on the Wild Side News. I hope we can do this again.
Thank you, Sydney.
Thank you. That's the show. Next time, more adventures on the Wild Side News.